Oh, my grandfather had no idea of that. He wouldn't approve of that, of course. It's like, why do you want a showcase? Why do you want to spend the money? He was a very frugal man.
Yeah.
One day, because my grandfather was so heavily involved in community work, he told my auntie, I'll be out for long and I'll come back quite late today, about 6 o'clock or so. My auntie called up the contractor and said, okay, now is the right time. Bring them down. So the two glass case just covered the whole front section of the coffee shop. So there was no entrance, no entry. So the customers who came regularly to have coffee just walked away. However, we put on the showcase egg tarts and some cookies. And the sales was very good. You know, when people walked past, they saw, oh, I didn't know they sell egg tarts. Oh, they sell cookies. And the people started buying. Sales was very good. We used to sell like maybe one or two trays of egg tarts a day. But that day, that afternoon, the sales just skyrocketed to maybe 7 trays or 8 trays. So when my grandfather came back at about 6 o'clock, he saw the long queues. He saw the business that blossomed suddenly. And he kept quiet. He just walked in. Went to his favorite corner. He stood there and looked out.
Hey, Simis. Welcome to the Serves My Way podcast. I'm your host and producer, Ling Yang. And today, I'm very pleased to introduce to you the great-grandson of one of Singapore's most well-known and oldest confectionery around. It's almost 100 years old, having been established in 1935. And let's face it, when you run a business that's gone on for that long, that's a challenge. When you run a business that is entirely family run, that's a whole other level of challenge as well. So we have Fung come in to pretty much share about his life. What was it like growing up, where the business was such a huge component of everyone's life? How did the business start in the first place? And also, how did they do the big rebrand that they did a couple of years ago, where they were no longer just targeting their traditional 50 to 70 year olds, but also the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas, the 15-year-olds. Why has it been so successful? We explore all this and more in this episode. So are you ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the So This Is My Why podcast, where we talk to people about their whys and how they turn them into realities to inspire you to live your best life. And here's your host, Ling Ya.
Hi, Fung. Thank you so much for joining me today on the So This Is My Why podcast.
Thank you for inviting.
So I first met you through Elvin, who was a previous guest on this podcast. He's a mutual friend of yours. So when I was in Singapore, he said, let me show you a little bit around. And then he brought me to your shop, Tong Kang, which I had not actually heard of. And you were there to kind of show us around. And it was just incredible for me to realize that actually there's this shop that's been around for almost 100 years. And you are the fourth generation. And you are known around this country for your egg tarts in particular, which are diamond-shaped. I wonder, growing up as a fourth gen, this family business must have been your life. What was it like growing up for you?
It has been fun, actually, growing up in the coffee shop. When I was a young child, I wasn't supposed to be part of the crew to make the cookies. So I just ate them, and I got to choose what I wanted to eat. And so there are a lot of good memories playing with the dough at the shop, seeing my grandparents making the egg tarts by hand, and also enjoying the drinks. You know? I drank Horlicks when I was young. I would just pour it onto the plate, let it cool, and then I'll sip it from the plate. It's a very old-fashioned way of drinking. I saw a lot of people that came into the shop. That was the old facade of Tong Heng. It was a very old-fashioned coffee shop. And I really enjoyed growing up, especially during the Chinese New Year. The family has a very interesting practice. We do not go visiting each other. We will all meet at the shop. So it was like the point of gathering for the family during Chinese New Year. And all kinds of relatives come over at different time of the day. Then they will come and eat something, and then they will present the ang pao and gifts. Then they will go on to the next destination. Everything centers around the shop for for the family.
Was there an expectation for you that you must enter the family business?
Okay, when I was young, I was not involved in the operation. I was there because I'm a family member. Then when I was in my primary school, I helped my auntie to start the shop at those kiosks, which is not at Tongheng. So we had a food kiosk. Since young, I was actually helping out in the food business. About 4, 5 a.m., I would go and buy the noodles. And then by about 6:30 a.m., we'll be at the snack shop to bring down the laksa, the prawn broth. Then they will start selling the breakfast. Then I'll go to school. So that was like my childhood when I was young, Monday through Friday. After that, I grew out of this because I was busy at school.
But did the family say, once you're done with your studies, you must work with
No. They are very cordial. They do not obligate. They do not implicate who should be doing what. It's quite voluntarily that people come and help. I've seen many relatives coming in to help. They are quite happy in participating in the business, especially during the peak time. When I was done with army and then I went to Canada and then to USA to pursue my degree, when I came back to Singapore, I started working in the corporate world.
Citibank, StarHub.
Yes, yeah. When I was in the US, I was already doing trading. Actually, I liked doing business. I was doing import-export. I was also going to car auctions to buy and sell cars out of interest. So when I started working, after about 5, 6 years, one day my second aunt, her name is Rebecca, she invited me to lunch. So I brought her to a nice Japanese restaurant and then she popped the question, have you had enough fun? So I said, what do you mean? I said, well, I see that you're doing okay in the corporate world, but would you like to give the family brand a chance? Because I was the eldest grandson of the family. And she said, why don't you try and work in the shop and see if you enjoy working there? We hope that you could join the family brand and be part of us and to help the company grow. So I said, that sounds like a good idea. So I resigned from my job and then I worked in the family brand. When I worked at the shop, my job was actually to look at the operation and to walk around, to help out a bit. There was no expectation of what I should be doing. So when I reported to work, I was wearing a white t-shirt and slacks. I literally took off my tie and long lapel sleeve. There was really nothing I could do because I didn't know how to do anything in the business. I only knew how to eat cookies. So I started taking out the dirty pan and I started scraping it. My grandma was furious. She looked at me and said, why are you doing this? I said, oh, I'm helping out. I didn't know what to do. Then after that, I started to learn the trade and I started to get more involved in the front sales because I was also trained in sales in my previous capacities. And I started to get more involved in the business. The workers were a bit uneasy because I was like the eagle's eye watching over their shoulder. And I was quite peculiar about the customer service. So I started to correct how they should be doing things. The old staff didn't like me interfering with their work. They did the sabotage. All of them didn't turn up for work. At that time, I had a family meeting that night and I asked my seniors, my aunties, can we work without these workers? My aunties just said, of course not. The recipes came from our hands. And so, okay, let's go for it. So we worked very hard. And we went back to the old recipes, to revive the old recipes, to make things even better. But we couldn't cope with the sales because sales that time was quite good. Long queue formation and people came and buy in bulk. We worked until 3 a.m. every night. We still could not finish producing for the next day. But we were very happy. So after that, I started doing recruitment. I started recruiting staff from different countries, mostly not from the same family. Let's say someone wants to bring the whole family over to work. I would say no. Maybe one sibling, yes, but not the whole family. Because when they do a sabotage, the emotions are very strong. So there's this attachment that they had. So I would just say, no, I need a very diverse team so that everybody would do their work and everybody will work hard for the brand. I picked up even more into making the cookies. So I started teaching the workers how to do the cookies, which I earned their respect. I built a new team together with my sibling and my aunt, and we started to grow again from there.
So before we go into that, let's just set the context, because your family business started in 1935, so almost 100 years, by a great-grandfather who came all the way from Guangdong.
Yes.
Who was he and how did this entire thing start?
Way back in China, during the late Qing Dynasty. My great-grandfather grew up in the later part of Qing Dynasty. And during that time, China was quite messy because everybody was fighting against each other. There were a lot of struggle for power. And so the first wave of the Chinese leaving China was to LA, Los Angeles, which they thought was a mountain of gold. They call it Jing San. They call it the Gold Mountain. Of course, they realized it was a scam because they were sold as slaves for hard labor. Then some came back to tell their relatives and friends that please don't go to Jing San because it's a scam. So the next favorite destination was Nanyang. So what was Nanyang? Actually, they didn't know what was Nanyang because they don't travel out of China. They were leaving China because it was quite messy. So my great-grandfather came. He was almost penniless. He just left everything in China. He came with his spouse and set sail on a boat. So life was very tough when he arrived in Singapore. He started working as a coolie, carrying those grains and rice bags, and he made a daily wage. When he saved enough money, he started his first pushcart. Actually, that was way before 1935. As to when he started the pushcart, we don't really have any idea. It could be in the 1920s. Then he started saving up money again, and he started the first coffee shop in 1935.
And when did the egg tarts come in?
When he started the coffee shop, he saw a lot of coffee shops are Hainanese, and he saw what they sold. Then he realized that, I'm Cantonese, I want to be different. So he started selling coffee, tea, toast. Then he started to have a range of pastries, some cakes, cookies. And the egg tart recipe, I'm not sure when it started. Probably in the 40s, could be earlier. I wouldn't say we invented the egg tart because egg tart probably was an influence that came during the colonial period, when the British soldiers were in Singapore, the Portuguese were here. And there were some cookies even today that we have that have similar shapes of Western pastries, like the egg tart. We even have look-alike chocolate cookie, but it's not chocolate. We call it the golden shortcake. The flavors of our cookies are a little bit more British, I would say, probably due to the colonial influence. And to make this recipe work, he could not use dairy products. The dairy products in those era was quite repulsive to the palates of the locals. I'm not sure why the people in that era could not accept anything that's dairy. Maybe they're not used to eating it. There was no McDonald's at the time. It could be due to religion that they did not want to eat anything from the cow, not even cheese or milk. So he had to create recipes using the Chinese ingredients. One of it is using lard as the oil, so to replace butter and flour and other ingredients to make it look like the Western pastries. But of course, we are not pro-Western pastries. We also have a lot of Chinese cookies, like the tau sa piang, the red bean pastries, the wedding flavors, which we are also quite popular.
Wasn't your great-grandfather, when he opened this shop, this was the time when the gangs would come and say, pay me protection money?
That was very long ago, yeah. Where he started his pushcart, not at the shop. Mm-hmm. He was a very tall man, I think about 1.87 meter tall. And he was known to be very fit because he grew up in the Qing court.
He learned martial arts.
He played with those soldiers and they taught him martial arts. And he was very strong. And when he became a coolie, he was even stronger. He has built a lot of strength. So when he started his first pushcart store, he was like the peacekeeper. Then when he saw the coolies fighting, he would tear them apart. Or he would even beat up the bad guys. So one day, you know, when he first started, the thugs came and they asked for protection money. So he said, "Hey guys, I spent all the money to start this store, this pushcart, and that was all the money that I spent onto the hardware. I don't have any money left. If you could come back tomorrow or the day after, you have my word, I'll give you everything that I've earned." Then they said, "No, then you get out of here." So they started a fight. Single-handedly, he beat them up.
How many were there?
I heard there were at least 7 to 10 of them. The next day he started his pushcart. He knew that he created some trouble, so he went to another corner. He found it very strange. The street was unusually crowded, and everybody was talking in front of him and behind him, and people started pointing fingers at him. So he knew that he had to face the music. Maybe the police would come after him. He had to be apprehended for fighting, maybe. So he just ignored. Then suddenly someone stepped forward, identified himself as the chief, and approached my great-grandfather and said, "We knew what happened yesterday, and here is this gift for you." He opened. It was a pistol. So he told them, no, I don't need any weapon. If you need any help, just call on me." So everybody was so happy, and they clapped their hands. Say, "Oh, we have identified the peacekeeper who will keep Chinatown safe from the thugs." So then his second day of business just blossomed, you know. It was so popular. So in the many stages of this brand that went up again and again, there was a little boost.
What was the next big boost?
When it started in 1935, everything was running well. Then came the World War II. The shop started actually before World War I. So World War II came, it was immense hardship for everyone. We were under oppression from the soldiers. It was very tough. Of course, we have to endure. Then there was even the bombing by the Japanese. The bomb actually missed our shop slightly. It bombed the cinema. There was a theaterette opposite our shop. The theaterette actually was destroyed by one of the bombs. So the shop was actually very popular during that time. Then came World War II. So everything just stopped. My ancestors, they endured the hardship, and they tried to put the pieces back together. After the bombing, the wooden frames in front were all shattered. My grandfather just used some wood to barricade the shop. Then after a while, they started coming back to the shop and they started selling. So that was another era that the brand survived.
And then your grandfather actually told your two aunts, "I don't want you to take over the business." So what happened?
I'm not sure about that. Maybe he did. But traditionally, family business is handed to the sons. So my siblings were involved in the business when they were young. They had their own businesses outside, but they came back to help. There are a few aunts in the shop all the time, like my eldest aunt, Constance. They call it the Tai Tao Tai Mei. She helped to look after the business. Then my dad started his own engineering business that he pulled his brothers out and said, "Why don't you let the sisters continue the business and we brothers will go out and we do our own engineering business." And everyone was okay. My grandfather was actually a very, very kind and nice man. He never really dictated what people should do. He would just let it flow. I really enjoyed talking to him too, because he was a very helpful man. He helped many people who came to the shop, who asked for help, and without even asking for any favors in return. At the time, he was quite involved in community work, and he was like the spokesperson for Chinatown. So whenever the people needed help, he would connect to the office bearers, even finance minister, and that's how people earned the trust in the system. Everybody prospered that way. It was quite amazing, actually.
Hey, Steamies, just interrupting this to say that if you are really enjoying what you're hearing, please do subscribe to the Steamy newsletter as well. You can find the link in the show notes for this episode at sothismari.com/140. With the newsletter, you get updates on all the new episodes that are coming up, also the behind the scenes and all things about how to build your personal brand online as well. So if you'd like to learn more about Steamy beyond these weekly episodes, please do subscribe to the Steamy newsletter. Now let's get back to this episode.
And when your two aunts took over as well, they brought about a lot of changes. Like the calligraphy that you see on the pillars is by your aunt.
Yes.
On the box is also seen by your aunts as well. I think one of them brought in the glass cabinet that's at the shop. Yes. What are some of the stories you can share about what they have brought to the business as the third generation?
Okay. My second auntie, Rebecca, she's very artistic. She was very good at whatever she wanted to learn. She did fashion designing. She had her own fashion designing boutique. She had her own snack shops outside, the cookie shop, the coffee shop. And she even helped draw blueprints for my dad at the engineering business. She was quite multi-talented. She wanted to improve the business at the coffee shop, because before the 1980s, the coffee shop at the time had a spittum, and the patrons who come to the shop are usually more senior gentlemen. They will smoke on the table. They will buy a cup of coffee and they'll sit there for 3 hours or longer to read newspaper or to chit-chat. So one person per table and the legs on another chair. So it was quite unkempt. It was quite difficult for young families to come in to support the shop or to even experience the cookies at the shop. And at the time, all the cookies were kept in wooden cabinets. So nobody really saw what we sold. Only the regulars would come in and say, oh, I want an egg tart with a coffee. Otherwise, nobody really know. Oh, this is just another coffee shop that makes very nice coffee. My grandma roasts her own beans in the back lanes. So it was just another coffee shop. And my aunt had this vision. The vision was to make it into a retail concept. He appointed a contractor to make the glass cabinet that's made of stainless steel and the glass with a glass showcase in front.
And your grand did not know about
this? Oh, my grandfather had no idea of that. He wouldn't approve of that, of course. It's like, why do you want a showcase? Why do you want to spend the money? He was a very frugal man.
Yeah.
One day, because my grandfather was so heavily involved in community work, he told my auntie, I'll be out for long and I'll come back quite late today, about 6 o'clock or so. My auntie called up the contractor and said, okay, now is the right time. Bring them down. So the two glass case just covered the whole front section of the coffee shop. So there was no entrance, no entry. So the customers who came regularly to have coffee just walked away. However, we put on the showcase egg tarts and some cookies, and the sales was very good. You know, when people walked past, they saw, oh, I didn't know they sell egg tarts, oh, they sell cookies, and the people started buying. Sales was very good. We used to sell like maybe one or two trays of egg tarts a day, but that day, that afternoon, the sales just skyrocketed to maybe 7 trays or 8 trays. So when my grandfather came back at about 6 o'clock, he saw the long queues. He saw the business that blossomed suddenly. And he kept quiet. He just walked in, went to his favorite corner. He stood there and looked out. And my aunties, of course, they also kept quiet because they were ready to be spanked by him because they just changed the whole business model without consent. How dare you? But it was good, and it worked.
And so your grandfather never said anything?
No. And he said, let's continue. So all the tables and chairs were gone.
Yeah.
No more coffee shop at that time. But that was the end phase of our shop at Smith Street. Condition of the shop houses along Smith Street was quite bad at that time because it was built without foundation. It was just made of wooden planks. And the Singapore government wanted to preserve the structures, to preserve the facade of the heritage buildings. So they chased away all these tenants, and we were one of them because we rented from the government. Then when we asked them, how long do you need? They said, we don't know, maybe 1 year, maybe 3 years, because they have to do a lot of structural reinforcement to make it safe. In those days, those buildings, the stairway, there was no light. There were holes in between the steps. Wow. So you must know when to step left, when to step right, when to walk straight. We had to exit. And
you found a new place, which is near Maxwell.
Yeah, State. My auntie saw this shop. She called the real estate guy, gave him a check, and we bought over the shop. It was not expensive at the time. It was quite a brave move, because South Bridge Road was a road that people do not open after sunset. They call it the big road, which was quite prone to robbery.
When was this, 19?
That was in the late 80s. So when we took over the shop, the moving part was quite interesting. They literally pushed the oven across by hand. Everything was moved by hand. There was no mover even, because it's just across the street. So when we started the business, my auntie did something different. Later on, I asked her, why do you dare to open the shop after sunset? Along that road, there were primarily medicinal shops that sell herbs, pawn shops, jewelry shops, maybe one or two tailors, but none of them would open after sunset. So by 6:30 p.m., that's it. They would pull down the shutter and they go. There were a few cases of robberies. So they were afraid that the robbers would come and rob them. However, my auntie opened after midnight, and she just filled the whole shop with fluorescent tubes. It was so bright that you could see like a shining star from far away, a few hundred meters away. And people would say, hey, we're hungry, let's go somewhere to eat. Then there was this shop that sells soybean, that sells jichong fan, porridge, noodles, and cookies. It was quite an interesting twist that there was this shop that was open along the big road, and at that time people would just park freely after 10 p.m. by the roadside. Then they come for supper. So when I asked my aunt, why would you dare to open after sunset? She said, we don't have much money from selling all this. In fact, we don't mind even if they come and rob us, because not much money for them to take. Please help yourself with some noodles for supper too. So she was quite candid about the whole thing. What she meant was, no robbers would rob us because we didn't have gold or silver. There's nothing expensive for them to take away. So that was another change in the whole business.
I want to talk more broadly as well, because a family business is not just your few aunts. There were so many, many, many people involved in the entire operation. Don't you have one aunt that specializes just in cracking eggs? And she can just take one egg and just know how old it is.
Yes, we have different specialization. My aunts, all of them have their roles. I have four aunts. One of them is a housewife, so she's more like the legal advisor. The other aunts are quite hands-on operationally. There's this aunt in particular, she does the cracking of the egg by hand every day. She's so familiar with the eggs that she sometimes could even tell if the egg was spoiled. So one day the farmer's daughter came and we had a chat. So my aunt demonstrated her skill to the farmer and said, oh, from this egg I could tell how old the hen is. The farmer was shocked. It's like, how do you know? You're not even a farmer. I said, oh, I crack thousands of eggs every day. So yeah, it's second nature to me. And everybody laughed. So we have a very close relationship with our farmers, because we require the animals to be fed natural food, grains, proper food, so that would derive better coloration of the egg yolk. So no adding of chemicals or other things to make up for the coloration loss. This recipe is very old-fashioned because we don't use chemicals to stabilize it. We just use very fresh ingredients, and that is how we make the cookies.
And for a business that's been running for so long, there's that challenge of keeping it fresh, making sure you appeal to the younger generation.
Yes.
The younger generation now is very different from the ones before, and you recently did this massive rebrand. What was behind the concept of rebranding this time?
We have done a few rebranding. Around 2000, we did one rebrand. We introduced packaging for wedding. After that, we realized that our brand was getting old. And honestly, it was very, very challenging for us because our costs were going up and our revenue was beginning to dip year on year. If you talk about 2 to 3% dip per year, after 10 years, it's 30% dip or more. And it snowballs, you see. We can't sustain when the costs keep going up, revenue keep dropping. Of course, we could raise price, but that does not really solve the problem. Because the problem was people are beginning to forget our brand. Then we started to analyze and to understand that, oh, after so many years in business, our customers have also grown in age. And the younger generation, their pursuit of food is different. Bubble teas, something more trendy. We have been searching for a brand consultant for about 10 years. So I was with my sister, we went to a few brands and we talked to them. The vibes just didn't quite gel with us until we found this branding company.
Ann Larry.
Yeah, the company is called Ann Larry. The gentleman is Larry himself. He's also our customer. When my sister approached him, said, oh, I'm your customer, I know your brand. Then what do you need? I said, oh, we need to do a rebrand. Are you able to help us? How much does it cost? And he said, rebrand is quite difficult. We can have a meeting. The meeting was the open discussion. Some questions will pop out.
And like
then he said, oh, how long your brand has been around? And I said, oh, maybe about 80, 90 years or longer. And he said, who are your target customers? Oh, they are in the 50 to 70s. Then he asked this question, which was quite interesting. So you want to target at this demographic group? Not bad. These are your customers. Business should be good. Then he asked, so what is 20 plus 50? The answer was 70. What's wrong? I said, oh, then at 70, can they eat a lot of your cookies? I mean, it's very realistic. You know, when people age, they will eat less sweet food. The dietary preferences will change. Then he said, a rebrand lasts 20 years. That's why I asked, so what is 50 plus 20? But 70, then how do you continue the brand? So it makes us think, how should we change the whole formula in rebranding? So it was suggested to move the demographic from 50 to 15. So Larry said, wow, this kind of money very hard to make. Because the 15-year-old don't really read the news. They don't Facebook. Their IG are private. They're in their own bubbles. And your brand doesn't do discount, promotion, tie-up. Plain vanilla. He said, wow, very difficult. But he took up the challenge. He said, I'm willing to take up the challenge. So we bite the bullet and hope that it will work. So he started doing a lot of graphics. And he often reminded us, what we do is in the eyes of the 15-year-old. You will not see what we do. Of course, we couldn't accept. You know, it's like, why do you do it this way? Why do you make the box green? But my seniors were very supportive. Fortunately, we let the branding company run the whole thing.
There wasn't tension within the family. There must have been some who said, oh, yes, go for it, another going crazy.
There was some resistance, of course. But Larry always reminded us, remember, your eyes are 50-year-old, you're 70-year-old, you can't see the 15-year-olds, you have to trust us. So it was, I will use the word blind faith. Even the mock-up box that he made, you know, this yellow box, flimsy, it was just made of A3 paper folded together. The Pantone color was totally off and it looked really bad. Then he said, this is only a mock-up. But when it was printed, it was really nice. To attract the 15-year-old to the brand, you cannot force them to come to you. Like giving them a flyer, brochure, doesn't help. Posting on Facebook, Instagram, doesn't help. Everything was private. Putting on the news doesn't help too. So they created a lot of animation, graphics, that made the brand very young, somewhat trendy, like hype. And it started to spread like fire amongst themselves. I started to see young people coming to the shop Yeah, talking about 13-year-old, 15-year-old.
Because it went viral on Instagram.
It went viral amongst themselves. Because we cannot infiltrate into their social media. They are very private.
What was it that drew their attention, though, that went viral?
It could be the new trend that we set.
Which is the packaging?
The packaging, the graphics, the animation.
What was the rationale behind some of those artistic decisions?
We left it to the designer to do it. Of course, he consulted us. All the elements in the art form relates back to the cookie shapes and the history of the brand. But it all fills into very cartoonistic, something very young. So this appealed to the young people, and I started seeing them coming to the shop, and they buy, and they put it in the mouth, and they take a picture, and they share in their social media, and they even bring it home. So there's something that's very difficult to earn their money. You could only attract them to you. Products like bubble tea, that is a no-brainer. They naturally are attracted to all this modern trendy food. But for old traditional food, it's very hard to make them adopt our food. And why did we target at the 15-year-old? Because when you plus 20 years later, which we hope the brand will last 20 years, they will be in their 30s. Then they will have their own young families and they will continue to patronize our brand. So then there's a brand continuity.
And let's not forget, you also have the older part of your customers as well. You told me once this story of this grandmother who came in a taxi. Can you share that story?
Oh, that was quite long ago.
Yeah.
I was at a shop in Chinatown, and one day I saw a taxi stop in front of the shop. The taxi didn't move away. Then an elderly lady with, I assume is her grandchild, alighted from the taxi. She came to me to give me a feedback. She said, oh, this cookie, I think it's not so good. The day I tried it, that's all she said. Then I said, can I pay you back for the taxi fare? I'll give you a box of cookies. She said, no. And then she turned around, she went back to her taxi. She lived in Yisun, which is about 30 kilometers away. I was very touched by her gesture. She just came to give me a feedback. Of course, her grandchild could have a Facebook message us.
Yeah.
But because she loved the brand so much, she wanted to personally come down to tell us. I was so surprised and I felt so touched that she would do such a thing. And it really woke me up. I just feel that, yeah, I really have customers that love the brand so much that they would give feedback.
And how else are you reaching out to these people? Because you have the very young, you have the very old, but it's easy to be drawn by other new brands that come out all the time. How do you think about bringing the brand forward?
Honestly, we don't have a very far vision other than this branding that we hope would last 20 years because many things are changing. Ingredient prices are going through the roof. It's very expensive. And many businesses have also evolved and continue to evolve. And with the onset of COVID, a lot of changes came about too. So we just have to do our best and be very mindful with every decision we make, because sometimes decisions we make can also hurt us because we do not know the threats in the future. As to competition, we're not involved in competing with other brands. We feel that we are our own brand. We do our own things and we do what we think we are best at. And we accept that there are other brands out there who are also doing better than us. They are making more money than us, but that's okay. We have our customers, they have theirs. So this is the whole approach in business. Because if we start to give discounts, start a price war, it will only hurt our bottom lines. So what's the point? Just do what you're good at.
And how do you see your role in the company evolving? How does that fit in when you're working with so many family members?
Honestly, my role actually is quite simplified. I'm more administrative and I help out operationally. There are decisions sometimes that I participate in, yeah. And then my siblings are also involved in the decision making, and my sister and my brother. So we work as a family. And each of us have our things to do. We are all busy in our own ways.
Any advice for people who also are part of family companies or they're working with someone who is very, very close to them? And it's great when things go well, but it's not so great when tensions arise. Any advice for those kind of people?
I'm really not in the position to advise anyone, especially family businesses. Family businesses, I see the importance of working as a team, because when there are individualistic motives, then it's very difficult for the brand to carry on. So for family businesses, I feel that it's good to corporatize the brand. You have to separate the brand ownership to the family. Operationally excel, let them grow in their roles. The difficult part is when the family member steps in to impede other workers. For example, let's say a family member steps in as the manager and he starts to dictate everything. Then the staff will feel very difficult. So I feel that it's good to separate the ownership of the brand to the family. Then operationally, let the staff excel, guide them, let them grow, promote them, increase their salary.
For those who are listening to this and I think, oh, I've never had Tong Heng before, I'm coming to Singapore, what should they get? Because you have a lot that's on offer.
Our most popular item is the egg tart, but these are best eaten within 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would recommend egg tarts. We have quite a wide array of Chinese pastries, some colonial type cookies. We call them shortcakes. Feel free to come by and try them. In fact, we have made some dessert and now it's ready for dining in. You can come in and take a seat and enjoy the pastries.
Fong, it's been such a pleasure to have had you on. I wonder, having done both non-family work and also working with the family as well, do you feel like you've found your why?
Found my why. When I started working in the corporate world, my vision was very different, because in the corporate world you fight very hard, whether for revenue, whether to get things done. But when I stepped into the family business, everything just changed, because everything just slows down and I started to see things more clearly. And I learned patience, I learned problem solving. I realized that my strength was logic, so I applied that to what I do. I think it has been a very rewarding journey to be part of the family brand and to still be able to contribute to the business. There are more challenges ahead, of course. But my family, my siblings, we are still working as a team. We are holding on tightly to each other and we are braving the storms ahead. COVID was one of the most difficult time. We thought we didn't make it.
You did better than ever before.
Yes, we did better because we started our own delivery framework. We were not dependent on app-based services, which were asking for 35% kickback. Those would just destroy our bottom line. In fact, that would kill us even faster. So we started our own delivery platform. We engaged a delivery company to do the delivery for us. We knew about our product, when to order, how soon they will get it. They may get it 3 days later. Our customers were very kind and they accepted. They were so supportive of our brand. I'm very thankful actually COVID brought about changes, not just to my brand, even to the economy as a whole. It made people want to step forward to the future. For example, in the past when you ask a hawker, do you do delivery? They say, no, we don't have such thing. But during COVID, it was different. Everybody wanted to do delivery because survival was essence and some didn't make it. Each obstacle that we dealt with, we were very careful because it could either make or break us. Fortunately, we did better each time.
And what kind of legacy do you want to leave behind?
I hope that this brand will continue to bring more smile to people and to touch more lives. And I hope that the generation will be passed on to the future. We hope that they will still remember this brand existed in history. I think we are one of the oldest Chinese pastries around. And we are happy that we are still on the survive list. And hopefully, with the support of more people, we will continue to serve our customers.
And what do you think are the most important qualities of a successful person?
Most importantly, perseverance and also the vision to see what is ahead.
And where can people go to find out more about who you are, Tong Heng is, buy your pastries?
Google and search for Tong Heng. Usually we are in the list. Our location is at 285 South Bridge Road. So you may see me at the shop sometimes. Yeah, but I hope that you come to my shop and to support us.
And that was the end of episode 141. The show notes can be found at sothismywhy.com/141. If you want to see the video recording of this, just head over to YouTube and look for So This My Why. The video was actually taken in a studio called Limbe Studios in Singapore. And if you too want to have a setup very similar to what I've done, just head over to headmail.com/Limbe Studios for more information. And if you haven't done so, please do subscribe to So This My Why, and see you next Sunday with a new episode.